Question: are there works of art that are made today that do not walk on the crutches of avant-garde habit, that do not have the tone of avant-garde convention, that one can return to again and again as a resource of inner life? How many works of art made today require a second glance? There are no doubt works that seem emotionally powerful and even deep, but rarely does one find a work in which the emotion and the medium seem one and the same. I am perhaps overstating my point, but the fact remains that the problem that motivated Kandinsky to write on the spiritual in art has grown greater and seems unsolvable, and that his art, his idea of an improvisational art, seems naive and inadequate in the current sophisticated situation of art. Kandinsky began Wither the New Art with a cynical statement from a famous scientist, Rudolf Virchow. Here's the statement: I have opened up thousands of corpses, but I never managed to see a soul, close quote. Kandinsky attacked Virchow's remark as an example of scientific and materialistic philistinism. In a sense, one might say Greenberg is the Virchow of art criticism and theory, just as the works of Stella and Warhol tend to be Frankenstein monsters, that is, technologically animated corpses. But it raises the important question: if one opened up thousands of works of art made today, how many souls would one see? Behind this question lurks another one: what state would they be in if they were there? One might ask, incidentally, how Kandinsky's improvisations, in practice, avoid the fate of Stella's and Warhol's work. In what does the radical unconventionality of Kandinsky's improvisations consist? If the core of scientific and materialistic philistinism consists in the power to measure and quantify, as has been argued, then Kandinsky's improvisations resist measure and quantification to the extent that they seem inherently unmeasurable and unquantifiable, altogether beyond scientific control analysis. You can't nail down their forms, the so-called amorphousness. They come to suggest the immeasurable, that is, the spiritual, in contrast to the material. The ancients were terrified of the immeasurable, the uncontrollable beyond, as it were, which was rationalized as sublime, and their art, which has been the model for so much subsequent art, is about measure and the sense of control and mastery measure brings. In contrast, one might say that Kandinsky's improvisations deliberately construct the unmeasurable in order to suggest the same sense of immeasurability that the churches and chapels he admired conveyed by way of color. He too uses color, which is experienced as unmeasurable, and thus suggests the immeasurable, the inherently unmeasurable, as it were. Color seems to transcend the environment in which it appears. It is materially the case, even as it seems ungraspable and thus peculiarly immaterial. It can be separated from the object. Color is constitutive of space, but because its appeal is entirely to the optic sense, leaving the haptic sense unengaged, to use Bernard Berenson's terms, it seems boundless and intangible. In a very important book called The Measure of Reality, scholar, intellectual historian Alfred Crosby has shown that the segmentation of space and time into measurable, self-contained, modular units is the basis of Western scientific materialism. Kandinsky's improvisations achieve their spiritual effect by presenting unsegmented color, going altogether against the quantification of color which we find in Seurat, and thus seemingly spaceless and timeless color, that is, non-objective color. Such color is not firmly attached to or contained by objects, and in visual fact seems to float, that is, in sense experience, seems to float free of them, to the extent of existing independently, becoming, as it were, an amorphous subjective gesture which can never be seen in perspective, that is, measured and fixed in its place, which is what perspective does. Kandinsky's rebellion against measure, order, quantification, number may look psychotic, utterly unrealistic and irrational from a scientific materialistic point of view, which in fact is epitomized by the rational perspective construction of the traditional picture, but it opens up the possibility of a new vision of vision. Indeed, his improvisations return to what I want to call a prelapsarian vision of reality, reality with which one is in spontaneous spiritual harmony, so to say, that is, with which one has an inner relationship rather than a measurable, materialistic, and thus contrived relationship. It is the difference between the way reality appears when it is freely engaged, when it seems abstractly and spontaneously expressive, and the clear and distinct way it begins to appear as one brings it under control by measuring it. I am suggesting that Kandinsky's improvisations in overthrowing the quantified picture are inherently more revolutionary than Cubism's quantifiable pictures, which still hold on to measure. Ironically, Kandinsky's improvisations show that one way of being modern is by rebelling against the modern vision of reality as measurable and quantifiable. That is, one way of making avant-garde progress is by regressing to a vision of reality that scientific materialism has discredited. The basic question that haunts on the spiritual art is what Kandinsky means by spiritual experience, keeps using this term. He never exactly defines it beyond associating it with religion and declaring it to be at the center of inner life. The German scholar Klaus Lankheit, who edited the Blue Rider edition, thinks that for Kandinsky, spirituality refers to, I'm quoting Lankheit, the subjective freedom of creative man, close quote. And another German expert, scholar Wieland Schmidt, thinks that Kandinsky wanted to, quote, raise the problem of the purpose of art, which is indeed a big problem today, by introducing the possibility of its spirituality. I think they are both correct, if incomplete, in their understanding of what Kandinsky meant by the spiritual. As I hope to show, they miss what is fundamental to spirituality for him and in general. Nonetheless, Lankheit and Schmidt make it clear that the crisis that led Kandinsky to attempt to create a modern spiritual art, an art that would unequivocally express a spiritual attitude, had two aspects. It was a crisis of creativity, that is, it involved the question as to just how much subjective freedom there is in creativity, how much it escapes from social codes, implying that if creativity is not completely free subjectively, if it is in any way bound by objective necessity, it is not really creativity. It was also a crisis that involved the question of the purpose of art, particularly in a scientific technological world, more particularly what art can contribute to human existence. In contrast, do we know what technology and science contribute? It is also a crisis that involved the question of the purpose of art, more particularly of its necessity, especially in the modern materialistic world. In other words, Kandinsky's spiritual crisis involved self-doubt, and I've written another paper arguing he had a kind of breakdown based on evidence in his letters and other sources and internal evidence in On the Spiritual and Art and other writings. That is, doubts about his creativity and implicitly originality, which correlated with his doubts about his subjective or inner freedom and also uncertainty about art's raison d'etre, its reason for existing. The latter is in part an extension of Kandinsky's uncertainty about the purpose of his own art. Broadly speaking, Kandinsky's spiritual crisis was haunted by the unresolvable question of the relationship of freedom and necessity in the creation and significance of art. Perhaps the immediate issue for Kandinsky was whether artistic creativity could hold its own against scientific and technological creativity, that is, materialistic creativity. They contributed a great deal to human welfare. What did art contribute? Science understood the workings of nature. Technological inventions facilitated human life. What did art understand? How facilitative of life are art's inventions? We know how life serves art, that is, how life finds its way into art. The desperate modern question is how art serves life, that is, what place art has in modern life. These questions force Kandinsky to rethink the basis of creativity and the purpose of art. The problem for him was to give art a sense of creative purpose that would confirm that it was humanly transformative, not simply socially routine, and equally important, that it would make it convincing and compelling in a materialistic world that was, as he repeatedly stated, indifferent to it, except to the extent that it mimicked the materialism of its times. His desperate answer to all these questions was to conceive of art as the repository and refuge of the spirituality the material world repudiated and shunned. What both Lonkheit and Schmidt miss in their important interpretations of Kandinsky's insistence on the spirituality of art is the combative, polemical way in which Kandinsky presents its views. In fact, it's perhaps the most polemical text that I know of and by a modern artist. I have always been struck by the sheer force of will animating on the spiritual and art. The spiritual is a force to be reckoned with. For Kandinsky, the spiritual attitude exists in and through its opposition to the materialistic attitude, that is, it exists dialectically, with which it is at war. Just as the internal necessity that informs, indeed drives, the spiritual attitude exists in and through its opposition to the external necessity that motivates the materialistic attitude. Spirituality comes into its own, becomes deeply meaningful and transformative art and life only as resistance to and transcendence of materialism. Such resistance and transcendence are clearly, quote, religious, close quote, in character. The ultimate religious ambition, the ambition realized by the saints, and I believe that Kandinsky thought he was a kind of saint, the holy man of modern art, or at least a prophet announcing his potential holiness, involves transcendental resistance to the everyday world in order to enter a more extraordinary, quote, higher, close quote, world of experience. And I'll talk more about what that means in a moment. It is a world that seems fresher and more alive than the everyday world, a world that seems to have been just created, just come into being. Kandinsky's abstract improvisations are meant to be as otherworldly as traditional religious renderings of otherworldly beings and experience. They are meant to show the creative forces, the creative conflict between spirit and matter, light and darkness, as Kandinsky himself says, using the language of Gnosticism, that brought the world into being and remained alive and active in the inner world. It is as though Kandinsky has projected himself into the moment of origination, as Schmidt says, and witnessed the creation of the world from the inside. What Schmidt calls his cosmic landscapes are microcosms of primordial process, of the creative process, which inevitably involves the processing of emotions, indeed, one's deepest emotions about existence. For Kandinsky, the basic formal elements of art are otherworldly in import, however this-worldly their properties. Non-objectivity, then, means otherworldliness for him, and otherworldliness means recovering, otherworldliness in the midst of this-worldliness, means recovering a sense of the freshness of being, which is embodied in the formal dynamics of the work of art. For Kandinsky, non-objective art is the only means of transcendence, the only means of transcendence of the objective, practical modern world. In other words, it has, and this is why art has a special place for him, it has a higher purpose than art that objectively reflects that world or that takes objectivity and practicality for granted. He's made a place, special place for art. One might say that where modernity involves extending the sway of scientific objectivity that discovers and conveys material necessity, non-objective art affirms subjective freedom in defiance of it. The tone of lyric defiance in Kandinsky's writing, it is happily a long way from the pseudo-epic theories of conceptual artists, in and of itself suggests the transcendence inherent in subjective freedom. Thus, ironically, Kandinsky's non-objective art, which has been understood as a revolutionary modern art, is anti-modern in spirit. Clement Greenberg once said that abstract art reflected the materialistic positivism of modernity, but Kandinsky's abstract art refuses to do so, which is no doubt why Greenberg did not care for it. He did not believe in the possibility of transcending the basic attitude of one's times. Greenberg accepted what Kandinsky called, quote, the harsh tyranny of the materialistic philosophy, close quote, even in art. For Greenberg, spirituality, as I've said, was simply an effect of the manipulation of the material medium, the result of complete submission to it rather than transcendental use of it. I am suggesting that the spiritual crisis motivating on the spiritual and art is at bottom a crisis of transcendence and ultimately of religious faith, faith in the self's ability to transcend the objectively material world through its own subjective creativity. Kandinsky had in effect come to doubt that art was a vehicle for creative transcendence. that it could transmit a sense of transcendence of what it represented in the act of representing it, indicating the artist's spiritual superiority to it, that is, implying that the artist's creative subjectivity is more to the human point than materially given objective reality. The artist's fundamental act of creativity consists in projecting his or her subjectivity with all its problems into objective reality, creating into it, to use D.W. Winnicott's eloquent phrase, all creativity frame is creating into something, making it seem humanly meaningful as distinct from merely materially the case. The appropriation of some aspect of objective reality as the temporary sensuous form for the artist's subjectivity imbues objective reality with a spiritual consequence it otherwise lacks. It was Kandinsky's spiritual crisis, involving doubt of his own creativity, as noted, generalized into the disturbing feeling that art had no purpose. This art that he had given up a rather promising career as a lawyer and professor to pursue, and that now seemed to be abandoning him, that led him to abandon the representation of objective reality for the direct presentation, as it were, of his objectivity, which he had in effect lost contact with. In a sense, Kandinsky reasserted art's divine right to creative transcendence in order to rediscover and renew his own subjectivity, to heal himself, as it were. To put this the other way around, he in effect subjectified art to regain faith in himself and his own creativity, giving art a sense of transcendental or spiritual purpose in the process. If crisis is understood in the sense in which Hippocratic medicine understands it and still used today, namely as the critical moment when the outcome of an acute sickness is in suspense, when it is about to change dramatically for the better or the worse, then we can say that Kandinsky emerged from the sickness of his own subjectivity with a new sense of his personal significance and creative power. That is, the power to endure and transcend his objective situation in the material world. I am suggesting that Kandinsky experienced what Viktor Frankl, great psychoanalyst, calls an existential neurosis, that is, quote, frustration of the will to meaning. Indeed, a sense that human life, especially inner life, had become meaningless in the modern scientific, technological, materialistic world. Meaninglessness is associated with deep depression, and with it art, the keeper of inner life, as it were. As Frankl says, such a crisis is spiritual, this is his own word, because it involves loss of belief in the possibility and even reality of spiritual experience, kind of paradox there. According to Frankl, and let's get down to what spirituality means now, spirituality means, I quote, freedom in the face of three things: the instincts, inherited disposition, or your constitution, your genes, as we would say today, and the environment, close quote. Spiritual experience declares, quote, the freedom of the spirit in spite of nature. It's a distinction that William James also makes in the varieties of religious experience. To use Ernest Becker's words, psychiatrist, spirituality involves, quote, the problem of personal freedom versus species determinism. Or as Silvano Arietti, a very great psychiatrist who wrote on schizophrenia, writes, spirituality means, quote, the attempt to increase the capacity for choice and to decrease determinism in every possible way, to move away from physical necessity and toward free will, close quote, which is a basic definition of health. In other words, spiritual or subjective freedom involves the transcendence of natural and social determinism in whatever form they take. More broadly, spirituality involves the general experience of transcendence, that is, what Eric Fromm calls the ex or mystical experience that is, as he says, and all quotes here, the substratum of the religious attitude as distinct from any particular religion. It involves the negation of the world and history and the self that is their expression, and at the same time, the liberation of the all-embracing love latent in the selfless self that survives the negation. The ex-experience, he says, is expressible only in poetic and visual symbols, close quote, and underlies or stands behind, quote, the most widely differing systems of religious orientation, close quote. He argues that they are, quote, various conceptualizations of the way to realize the ex-experience, close quote. However, transcendence, as he says, and I want to emphasize this, does not mean a movement toward a transcendent God, has nothing to do with God, but refers rather to the transcendence of a narcissistic ego, which is an early determinism also, that is, to a goal within man himself, close quote. That is, transcendence means inner liberation from authority, divine or human. Spirituality separates human beings from animals, who find transcendence incomprehensible, indeed unthinkable, for it is beyond the ken of their existence, which submits to the authority of instinct. It's deterministic. The less instinct rules one's existence, the more one feels able to transcend it and enjoy the experience of transcendence in general. At its core, the feeling of transcendence involves the experience of inseparability from the cosmos at large, and that's what Kandinsky is trying to give us, and with that, a renewal of integrity. David Bohm, important physicist philosopher you may know of, describes it in terms that seem especially appropriate to Kandinsky's art. They resemble those I have tried to use to understand it. He regards mystical experience as, quote, an attempt to reach the immeasurable. Think back to what I said earlier. That is, it's a state of mind in which one ceases to sense a separation between oneself and the whole of reality, close quote. It is a state of mind in which one no longer feels determined and measured by ordinary reality. Freud regards this oceanic experience, as it's been called, as regressive and narcissistic, which is accurate, but misses the reason, indeed necessity, for such narcissistic regression in a society that seems alien and indifferent, that is, lacking in empathy. In such an emotionally unfacilitative world, which brings with it the threat of psychic disintegration and annihilation, oceanic experience, which is the moment of transcendence or cosmic merger, implicit in what I want to call healthy narcissistic regression, affords a sense of insular union with the whole of reality beyond one's immediate reality, one's everyday reality. What is ordinarily forced to comply to it in order to materially survive. Oceanic experience also transports one beyond the socially ugly world at large, and the world is profoundly ugly. One tends, as a society, one tends to submit to it because one realizes that every attempt to revolutionize it is likely to end in failure. That is, the construction of what calls itself a new world order, but that demands old-fashioned compliance. Thus, mystical experience, which is what Kandinsky's art wants to mediate, becomes an important way of remaining emotionally healthy in an emotionally unhealthy world. More particularly, it becomes the major means of preserving, securing, and protecting the core self in defiance of an intimidating and debilitating social reality. It becomes a way of sustaining a sense of authenticity, to use an old-fashioned word, or true selfhood, or at least keep from becoming inwardly contaminated by one's compliant dealings with society. It is also a way to avoid becoming one of society's scapegoats. The creativity of mysticism is a weapon in protest against society's destructive scapegoating, insidious sacrifice of any creative individual it cannot find a collective use for, that is, misappropriate for its own glory, be it social or commercial or both. Kandinsky's early abstractions are attempts to convey the X or mystical experience, that is, to realize it through transcendence of the social determinism implicit in representation of the world. Initially, he found suggestions of transcendence in nature. It is a familiar romantic discovery involving the transformation of the inevitability implicit in nature, that inevitability we call instinct, into the sense of freedom called transcendence, ultimately freedom from or transcendence of nature itself. In a sense, Kandinsky's early abstractions improvise spirituality out of instinctively felt sensations of nature, more particularly out of primordial sensations of naturally given colors. And he talks about this to some extent. For Kandinsky, vivid color is not only a sign of natural vitality, but also evidence of eternal life, if you please, even a trace of it. For color is the earthly catalyst and carrier of the X experience. That is, it is the transcendence immanent in nature. Thus, Kandinsky's improvisations are mystical experiences, the more familiarly perceptual epiphanies of color. They pay homage to its transcendental power. Transcendental experience is there for the asking in even the most familiar color, if one knows how to ask. Kandinsky conveys this inherent transcendence by liberating color from confining line. In his improvisations, color is uncontainable and infinitely expansive, indeed an expanding, boundless cosmos of mystical experience. The basic question for Kandinsky is whether art is inherently transcendental, whether it conveys freedom from objectively given nature and society, or whether it is determined by and is such a reiteration and reification of various aspects of them. His final conviction that art expresses the will to transcendence that differentiates human beings from animals has to do with his discovery of his own personal power of transcendence. Internal necessity means the discovery that there is something in inner life that resists and transcends the external necessities of existence. Marx called these things conventions, and his and Kandinsky's deliberate pursuit of unconventionality signals their defiant assertion of freedom from external necessities or determinisms. Thus, Kandinsky's improvisations are in effect spiritual exercises, and I mean this in the sense in which Loyola used that term, that is, artistic exercises meant to generate a sense of personal freedom and transcendence. The issue today is that spiritual freedom seems more and more improvised and as such uncertain and even untenable. This is no doubt because it is no longer anchored in religion, which has been discredited, bringing the idea of spiritual freedom into intellectual disrepute. But it is an emotional matter, not an intellectual matter. And the question is whether contemporary artists have the emotional capacity that Kandinsky had, whether they are willing to go through the emotional struggle he went through. Like Kandinsky, the contemporary artist stands at the beginning of a new century, but it is a different century. Kandinsky's century is over, and the artist today no longer knows what it means, quote, to make it new, as Ezra Pound famously said the 20th century artist should do. It is not even clear that he or she realizes, as Kandinsky did, that sometimes one can only make art new by returning to old ideas. Kandinsky's belief that the artist must live for the spirit the way, as he said, and I'm quoting, the divine martyrs and servants of humanity did, and through his art reawakened spiritual life, seems absurd. The third chapter of On the Spiritual and Art is called Spiritual Revolution. But the spiritual revolution of art that Kandinsky started, and I think, as I said, he's much more of a revolutionary than Picasso ever thought of being, seems to have failed. It is doubtful that modern art ever made anyone spiritual, changed his or her lifestyle and attitude to a spiritual lifestyle and attitude, however much one may continue to believe, as Kandinsky did, and I quote, that art is one of the mightiest elements of the spiritual life, and as such is a major weapon against the modern sense of insecurity, all quotes, that is a source of spiritual security. Nor is it clear that art is the best way of discovering what Kandinsky called the internal truth about oneself, which is what so-called self-expression in art is about. Perhaps the biggest problem facing artists today is that they no longer believe that art is an element of the spiritual life, let alone a mighty element. No longer believe that to make art is a spiritual activity, however much some may still believe that it can be a vehicle of the internal truth, that is, of the truth of the self. But one wonders how much their inner life involves the internal necessity that drove Kandinsky to make his art. I am suggesting that the future for a spiritual art looks bleak, although there are spiritual artists working today, I believe, truly spiritual work. But then again, as Kandinsky and Marx demonstrate, only a few artists are needed to affirm its possibility, and it was never meant for more than the happy few, despite Kandinsky's utopian, not to say delusional, belief that it would lead everybody out of the materialistic wilderness. The question today is, where are the few artists who are ready and willing to reaffirm the spiritual, and more crucially, you can convince us that their art does so, that it is a beacon of transcendence in dark materialistic times. How is an artist to keep alive the idea of transcendence in a world in which it has become trivial, passé, incomprehensible? Kandinsky had a messianic complex behind which lurked a martyr complex, and this is quite demonstrable, but neither is any guarantee of transcendence today. It is a difficult task to think of transcendence, let alone assume the reality of mystical experience, in a world that seems to have usurped and manipulated our subjectivity and whose deterministic hold on our lives seems more complete than ever. It is a world in which it is hard to gain a critical distance from the determinisms which shape our existence, to take a critical stand against the external forces that seem to determine even our inner lives. Every critical analysis of some determinism, personal or social, every effort to transcend it by analyzing its structure and effect, for such analysis affords transcendence when it is made out of internal necessity, not simply out of intellectual curiosity, as Spinoza argued, quickly becomes another deterministic theory. I think it is more difficult than ever to be a spiritual artist, but in my opinion, it is the only kind of heroic artist that makes sense in threatening modern times, as Kandinsky makes clear. Thank you. Thank you.